Good morning. The Government Operations Committee will come to order. And do I have someone to approve the minutes, please? We have two sets of minutes, so I'd first... Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nash, for having moved the minutes for the Government Operations Committee for March 10th. And we also have a second set of minutes to approve for the... For the joint committee that was held yesterday, March 10th. Do I have someone to move the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott, for having moved the minutes for March 10th.
Madam Chair, we need to vote on both of those.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. If I could ask please, if there's any discussion on the minutes for the Government Operations Committee on March 10th. Does anyone have any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, and thank you. And also, is there any discussion on the minutes for the Joint Committee of the Government Operations and Civil Law Committee? Seeing none, all approve, say aye.
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 And opposed? Say, the minutes are adopted. Okay, so I've been looking forward to today's hearing, and I would like to welcome Chairman Hamilton to the committee. If you would like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe I'll need somebody from the committee to move it.
I would like to move House File 777. And have it re-referred to the committee on, or is this it?
Higher ed.
Okay.
So.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Thank you, Representative Scott, for moving this, and also thank you to Representative Isaacson for moving the bill in the last committee. I greatly appreciate it. Members, this is just briefly how this bill came before me. He's in the audience here today. Rob and another gentleman by the name of Billy were passing by my office, and I yelled at him. I said, "Hey, come in here!" And they came into the office, and I was admiring at that time Billy's wheelchair because I was in the market, and we started talking about it. And I said, "What brings you to the Capitol?" And they said, "We have a grassroots effort here. We're looking for some additional dollars to be invested in research for spinal cord injuries and traumatic brain injuries." And I said, "Have you found an author?" And they said, "No." And I said, "Well, you have now. I'd be honored to carry the bill." And so that's the background on it. Madam Chair, I think this is the first time I've been before this committee, so I'm not sure how much detail you would like about the bill. I think what we could do, if it's okay with you, to take up the amendments first to get the bill in the shape in which we'd like to present it. And I think, Madam Chair, if we could take up the A1 amendment first, if that's okay, if I can
yes.
get somebody to move that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move the A1 amendment. And is there any discussion?
Just to the amendment, Madam Chair, the A1 amendment would... simply delete the provision in the bill that it talks about notwithstanding certain section of law, the advisory council does not expire. This was taken from old language. I'm not quite sure why that was in there. We think that it's unnecessary, and you know, if we aren't doing good work, it probably should expire is our thought. So I just simply ask for your support.
Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And opposed? And the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the next amendment would be the A2 amendment.
Yes.
And if I could get somebody to move the A2 amendment.
Yes, and Representative Hamilton, I'll move the A2 amendment.
And thank you, Madam Chairman. And I do have a testifier that can speak to this as well. If we could have him speak at this time.
Mr. Godfrey, if you would please announce yourself and who you represent.
Sure.
And then you can proceed.
Madam Chair,
Members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey. I represent Hennepin County Medical Center, and we are supportive of this bill, being a major center for traumatic brain injury research. And so I will just go over the A2 amendment quickly. It does really three things. First, on page 2, line 13, it just adds the name of the advisory council to the sentence, inserting spinal cord and traumatic brain injury council, advisory council. Then the second thing is on page 3, line 6. It deletes a sentence saying that the council is not subject to policies developed by the commissioner under the administration of administration under section 16B98. Again, this is another item that I don't think is typically this is another piece of language that's not typically included in bills having to, that set up advisory councils. We inherited this from the previous effort in 2013, and so on the advice of both House and Senate Council, we'd like to delete that. And then finally, on page 3, line 13, insert just a statement or a sentence saying that the commissioner shall provide administrative support to the council. And there's an appropriation for that purpose in the Section 3 appropriation section.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question that I have has to do with the deletion of the line 3.6 and 3.7. Maybe Mr. Shepherd can enlighten us what 16B.98 does and what are we... Why shouldn't they have to, should not be subject to that provision?
Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson and members, 16B.98 is the Office of Grants Management within the Department of Administration. They make some policies about grants, the process for making grants, generally that they be competitive and that they follow certain processes. And with this language deleted, this council would be subject to those policies like other councils are.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. That explains what we're doing. Okay.
Thank you.
And Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, I just ask for your support on this amendment as well.
Seeing no more discussion, those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed? The amendment is adopted. And to your bill, Representative Hamilton.
And Madam Chairman, like I said, this is the first time that I've been before this committee, so I'm not sure how much detail you want on the bill itself. What this bill does is, again, it offers grants towards spinal cord injuries and traumatic brain injuries. And we had some very compelling testimony. Emotional testimony, if you will, in the last committee. And Madam Chair, I believe you were there as well. And to understand the importance and how impactful this could be. And in the closing argument, simply the comment was this will provide hope to many individuals that haven't had it for a while. So, Madam Chairman, if there's any questions, we're more than happy to field those, I guess, at this time.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we, and I haven't had a chance really to read the entire bill, but is there involvement, say, from, you're from the Minnesota Medical, Hennepin County Medical, did you say, or which medical and facility would be involved in medical research facility?
Madam Chair, Representative, to answer that question, it may be helpful just to walk through Section 2 so you understand the membership of the Advisory Council. So if you go to page 2, line 10, this is Section 2 that establishes the Advisory Council. The membership is made up of four academic medical research organizations, including the University of Minnesota Med School, Mayo Med School, Courage Kinney Rehabilitation Center, and Hennepin County Medical Center. And then there's three physicians who have expertise in either spinal cord injury or traumatic brain injury, and then five community members who are either individuals who have a traumatic brain injury or spinal cord injury, two that are family members of one of whom would have a person in their family with TBI, the other with a person with spinal cord injury, and then finally a veteran. Actually, just a moment. Oh. And then finally, there's a rehabilitation specialist, and our intention actually on line 2.26, and I guess, unfortunately, this was not inserted into the A2 amendment, but was to have a veteran who is a person with a spinal cord injury or traumatic brain injury. And that is how it reads in the other body.
So, Madam Chair.
And Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then as to where the research would be done, just wondering, you know, if the author or the testifier, where the research would be done, is that at some Minnesota entity, or could it be anywhere in the country?
Representative Hamilton or Mr. Godfrey?
Madam Chair, Representative, the intent is that it would be done in Minnesota, and it could be available to any medical research organization, including for-profit medical device and other healthcare-related firms. And it also creates a grant and loan program in Section 1, Subdivision 2 for small medical research firms that have 500 employees or less that are located in Minnesota.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes. And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I know we're not the Finance Committee, but there's appropriations that are blank here. Do we know approximately how much you're looking for, or how much? I know that's part of the budget process, but do you know how much your ask is for those to fill in those blanks?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, our intention when we get to Finance Committee is to seek an $8 million appropriation for both fiscal year 16 and $8 million for fiscal year 17.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. And Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hamilton, for bringing this bill forward. I authored a version of this in the last legislative session, and I think it's improved greatly, and I'm really happy to see the progress that's been made, and thank the grassroots activists that have been so involved and engaged in this effort, and I'm happy to be a co-author of this bill. One thing I learned a lot about in the last legislative session was how much has changed in the field of spinal cord injury research and traumatic brain injury research. And I'm wondering if one of the testifiers could comment about where we're at today, because I found it to be quite surprising.
As Madam Chair and committee members, it is, you know, I mentioned about HOPE. Just this week, an individual sent me an email about some of the research around MS. And here we go again, right? And here it was about how it was stem cell research, and it was done over in Europe, and they put an individual on chemo to kill off, or first they harvested their stem cells, put the individual on chemo to kill off everything, and then put those stem cells back in. And the woman that they did this to, she was dancing. That's one example. We had, maybe you could speak to this. There was others where it was, and of course I'm not a doctor, and I won't be able to get this right, but it was as if they rewired an individual that had a broken spinal cord, and were able to reconnect, and they have movement and feeling once again. So we do have another testifier here that would be happy to visit on this.
Yes, welcome to the committee, and if you would please introduce yourself for the record and state which organization that you're representing.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matthew Roderick. I am one of those activists who've been behind this bill for the last several years, and I represent an organization called Get Up, Stand Up to Cure Paralysis Foundation. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. There are a number of new innovations in the last decade or so, but several especially in the last few years. And as some of you that we have met with know, one of my talking points is always that the places where those innovations have happened are places where the state has ceded funding for those innovations. So just a brief run through of some of them. There is a epidural stimulation device that is a re-engineered Medtronic device that was previously used for back pain. You may or not have seen the media blitz last year in the springtime. It's out of Louisville, Kentucky, which has a similar funding mechanism for spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury. Also at UCLA in California, there are several stem cell trials that for the first time ever this year and last year are being delivered for patients with chronic spinal cord injury. That's another focus for us, is that we've been focused on functional improvement for chronic injury. Majority of the research that happens in the United States is for acute injuries, which is great. We would love that people who are injured not remain injured or mitigate some of the secondary consequences. But of course, I have a son who's 22 and he has a spinal cord injury. That acute study will not do much for him. So we're pretty committed to the functional improvement for people who have an injury, of which there are a little less than 11,000 people in the state. Those are brand new trials for stem cell intervention. And that excites us quite a bit. And again, all of those projects were seeded at the state level to bubble up into innovations that are actually now going into people. We often joke in our community that we're sick and tired of seeing rodents and rats walk, and even some occasions primates. We would like to see that in the human population.
Thank you, Mr. Roderick. And Representative Hamilton, is there any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I just simply ask for your support.
Well, Representative Hamilton, you have my support. As you know, I've been championing this bill for some time and am so pleased to have the opportunity to hear this bill again. We heard this in the Higher Education Committee last week, and one of my constituents has been one of the courageous, brave testifiers and who's here today, and I just want to thank all of them, to echo Representative Halverson's comments. They've really been an inspiration to so many, and I would encourage everyone's support. So, having seen no more interest in commenting, I would renew Representative Scott's motion to re-refer this bill to the Higher Education Committee, House File 777, as amended. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed? So the bill will be moved to, the motion prevails, and this bill will be moved to higher education.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome back to the committee, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
A tough act to follow. Yeah, exactly. I'll go ahead and move House File 779 to Agricultural Finance Committee. And with that, we'll let you take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I like to start by saying I have a strong passion for agriculture. And what I say is, if you think it's scary dependent on foreign oil, wait until we're dependent on foreign food. And you take a look at a lot of the research that's going on out there and whatnot, or if you listen to the Food and Ag Organization of the United Nations, they will tell you, which are, by the way, the foremost authority on ag, food, and poverty, and they will tell you that we have to double the world's food supply in 35 short years. And we are looking at needing to feed 9.5 billion people. And the time is now. And you take a look, what had happened and brought this bill forward, if you will, it was the various commodity groups, ag business, et cetera, that got together in the interim. And they talked about the need for research. And Mr. Chairman, if I could please ask someone to give me a Kleenex and after the last bill, that would be great. Thank
there you go.
All right. Now I'll regain my composure and we'll move on.
Yep. So, take as long as you need.
So, Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. And what they ended up doing is they all came together. They brought forth a proposal to invest in agriculture research, agriculture education, and also the rapid response, Ag Rapid Response Fund. And that would help us to protect us from emerging diseases. And so maybe you've seen some of the recent news articles as far as what's taken place in the turkey operations, a few of them as well. And so, again, they came together, and these groups understand the importance of making sure that we have sound investments so that we can reach that goal of doing our part to feed the world. And you also take a look that we have University of Minnesota, a land-grant university right here. And what we've recognized is over the years, ag research has continued to decline. And with that, production outputs also, whether you look at cereal, grains, et cetera, have declined as well. And so there's very, very important to be able to do this. I believe we do have a couple amendments, Mr. Chairman, in order to get the bill. And
thank you, Chair Hamilton. I have the A3. It's the only amendment I have in my pack.
Yes.
I'll go ahead and move the A3. That is an office amendment, correct?
That is correct. And just to the amendment, Mr. Chairman, on line 1, page 1, line 15, it inserts the word statewide because we want that to be, representative from individuals, industry from the state of Minnesota. And so that's what that's all about. And then I also wanted a provision in there, visiting with some, for each board meeting, the commissioner shall provide advance notice of a copy of the meeting minutes. And the meeting itself to the chairs and ranking minority members of the House of Representatives. And that way we can be fully informed on what's going on and choose to attend if we wish. And so I ask for your support on that.
Any discussion to the A3 and author's amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like? Seeing none, all in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, to your bill as amended.
And so you take a look at the board, the members of the board itself. We have the Commissioner of Agriculture. We also have the Dean of the College of Food and Agriculture and Natural Resources from the University of Minnesota, a person representing the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, two persons representing the statewide ag organizations. That would be probably be Farm Bureau, Farmers Union would be some examples, ag industry, like I said, we made that change, so it's Minnesota. The commodity groups, and we have, I don't know if you want me to roll through all the various commodity groups here, and these are individuals that actually pay checkoff. And checkoff dollars, it's a mandatory checkoff, and that can be used for education, promotion, and research dollars. And what we've noticed, Mr. Chair, is there are some research dollars available out there through these private groups. What has taken place is we don't have the actual human capital to do the research. And so there are private dollars out there that we can do it. But again, if we invest in human capital at the University of Minnesota, once again, that is a land-grant university, we will be able to get additional dollars in order to complete that research. Where do I leave off? Manufacturers of forest products as well as a part of that. And in here you have state and federal agriculture commodity groups. Why do we do that? One example would be the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. They are registered as a national organization. And we didn't want to exclude that commodity group as well. Very, very important to this. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's any questions at this time, but I'd be happy to field those if there are.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton. Any discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair. question I have is the people that you're putting on the board, are they in support of the bill and they are willing to participate in this? I mean, you know, some of these places, the University of Minnesota being a land-grant institute that you talked about, we can't compel them to do anything or much of anything.
Yeah. Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, you know, it was interesting. We had the deans of the college come down and visit in the last committee as well. We've had, it was a comment, and I think I can share it, the president of the college, President Kaler, it was reported to me that he said he's been waiting for years for something like this to come forward as well. So I believe, unless I'm totally out of line, if there's anybody from the university, I feel very confident saying that they are in support of this.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson, good?
Okay.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. On line 1.18, I'm just wondering if that's the Ewell Gibbons provision?
Chair Hamilton?
I have no idea.
Mr. Chair, it deals with the primary manufacturers of forest products, and I'm just wondering when we're talking about food-related ag, how it would relate to... I mean, I love, you know, pine nuts, and but I don't know if that's what it's referring to.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you for the clarification. Sorry, Mr. Chairman and Representative Albright. Thank you for the clarification on that. And I do have a testifier here that can respond directly to that.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, introduce yourself to the record. Let us know who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Corey Bennett, Representative Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. In reference to line 1.18, Representative, that would be for manufacturers of forest products. That would be a lot of the paper mills, the Forest Manufacturers Association, those sorts of individuals. So the forestry products people.
Mr. Chair. Representative Albright.
Just a clarification, though. This is dealing with extension of making sure we feed our population, correct?
Chair Hamilton.
So that's the main emphasis for the facility of this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Albright, working again, and that was an amendment in the last committee. It was brought forth where we added production, ag research, so that would be the main focus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Representative Albright is showing his age when he references Ewell Gibbons. I don't think some of our younger members would know who that is.
I sir. Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
You know, and I do maintain, you know, a regular habit.
No Mr. Chair, please do not encourage this kind of behavior no discussion among these members.
Any other discussion? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hamilton. One of my nephews works at the U of M, and he works with dirt. And what he does is checks out dirt to see what happens with the soil and how it can be more beneficial. Will this also cover that? I would love to give him some job security.
Chair Hamilton.
He's got a family.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know what? It's interesting because I had an individual, if I can share a quick story here, I had an individual from Thailand that flew over here and I was talking to him about harvesting microbes in the soil. And there's a lot of research going on at the University of Minnesota to take a look at those microbes. And they're able to find the microbe that can help with the phosphorus to where you can limit the amount of phosphorus. But they haven't found the one that can pertain to the nitrogen piece. And this gentleman from Thailand says that he has found that. And it was said back to me that this would be, if they can unlock that, because the nitrogen is like 70% of the air is nitrogen. If they can find that microbe, that is like unlocking the Holy Grail, if you will. And so there's a tremendous amount of research going on right now, and that would pertain with the soils that would pertain to production ag. Absolutely. It's fascinating what's actually taking place. So, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look through this, I have some concerns about limiting factor to it. I think it's been mentioned in other committees that, for instance, you have here agricultural education, and you'll do mentoring programs, graduate debt forgiveness, and high school programs, but it's all geared to major approach to agriculture. What about the thinking that we need to be more local? We need to attend to what's going into our food production, such as organic. What about the CSA structure that is building up naturally, the community-supported agriculture? What about these things? How does this fit into this process?
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman, and thank you for bringing that up. Because whenever we're having these conversations, I simply say, I want it all. And I look forward to working with you on the Omnibus Agriculture Bill. This pertains to production ag research, but I'm also working very closely with Representative Clark and others about urban agriculture initiative ideas. And, you know, in the committee in which I am able to chair, I say that, you know, we're not going to tear down one segment of agriculture trying to promote another. I want it all. And there's room for all of us on this. And so there's various bills, whether it's a Forever Green Initiative, Urban Ag Initiative, different things to get minority cultures involved in agriculture. That does not pertain specifically to this bill, but those conversations are being had. And I'm very excited about what's taking place because we're looking at doing this all across the state. All walks of life, not only just certain segments or not specifically just to one area. That'll be addressed in the Omnibus Ag Bill, and I look forward to being able to present that as well.
Representative Lane.
But you're calling it agricultural research and education. Why is this what I consider an important segment left off?
Yes.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you. And to that point as well, I'll let one of the other testifiers talk about that. To that point, in whether you're looking at the pork producers, for instance, I was a past president of the pork producers. They have seen that. They've acknowledged that. They're taking a look at the various markets there as well and embracing that within these various commodity groups. But to that point, I'll let one of the other testifiers talk about it.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would, just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce Clavin. I represent the Minnesota wheat growers and some others. I wanted to jump in here. I'm just here for questions, but we had the similar question in ag from Representative Bly down the same bank. What we're looking at here is the research component. So, for example, in the wheat area, we look at the breeding varieties. What you're describing is a methodology of the production. Without the variety, you can't grow the wheat. So the private seed companies really don't do anything with wheat breeding or barley breeding, but the public universities do. Once the variety is developed, you can grow it conventionally, you can grow it organically, you can grow it however you want to. But without that basic research on varietal development, you won't have the wheat to grow. And you're getting more into the production method, which we're not necessarily dealing with here. That's a choice that you'd make on the farm. Some folks grow the wheat varieties conventionally, some grow them organically. So we're looking at the basic research. The second thing I would say about this in terms of the membership is that the wheat growers, Representative Hamilton described, the checkoff. There's a checkoff of a penny a bushel for every bushel of wheat sold in the state. Those dollars go towards the research at the university to develop those very varieties. So whether you're growing organically or conventionally, you're paying the checkoff in, and so it's the wheat growers who would be a member of the council. That's just an example of the kind of research that we're looking at. Once you get it out, it's a production method. And that's a choice the farmer would make.
Representative Lane?
Probably one of the things, I don't know that you're getting into it all, but agricultural research would also include whether some of those wheat varieties would be genetically modified. And then you have destroyed the other infrastructure that I'm talking about. So you can't just say you're doing the varieties and then you can produce it any way you want. The variety is key also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, if you started having a GMO discussion, that is more involved with the private seed companies who own the technology. I don't think we have a GMO function at the U of M. We certainly don't have GMO wheat. So I think that gets into the patent protection and some of those issues.
Any other discussion, members? Seeing none, Chair Hamilton, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the questions, and I ask for your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 779 be re-referred to the Committee on Ag Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 779 is on its way.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Chair Hamilton. Representative Keel, you can make your way to the table. And as she's coming up to the table, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to welcome our high school pages who have joined us. They're leaving. Three are from my district. One is my daughter. So,
welcome for joining us today.
Her day wouldn't be made unless I embarrassed her. So.
Well done. Well
Thank
done.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one of those is from my district, too.
Excellent. All right. Welcome, Representative Keel. I will move House File 278 to be referred to HHS Reform. With that, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that very much. I would like to introduce this, and then we have a little bit of a presentation. So this bill, I worked with Senator Nelson on, and her father has Alzheimer's, and I would guess that many of us in this room have had been touched by either dementia or Alzheimer's of some kind. I've dealt with it in my own family, and it is a challenging disease, but one that many of us may have to deal with in our lives, hopefully later than sooner. This bill provides a grant, a competitive grant program, to do Alzheimer's research to hopefully discover why or how we can delay the possibility of getting dementia or Alzheimer's. It also sets up this statewide grant program, and then also a grant program that provides for regional and local projects to help make the awareness of the disease. I think we all know about it, but how to handle it is a major issue. This bill would also help to communicate with citizens to teach them how to deal with the different memory loss issues that happen in our lives in such a way that hopefully we can keep our family members home longer, which is helps in the cost of memory care, and just helps them to and ourselves to have a more calm life. If you know how to deal with someone who has dementia, it really helps you to get through the day much easier. My personal experience, my grandmother used to escape from the nursing home when she could no longer remember many things. One of them was who I was. I had become her little sister, not her granddaughter anymore. And often the nursing home would call me. This is before we had any Alzheimer's units. She had a Wander bracelet on her, and she knew how to get around that. I watched her do it. It was very amazing. Could hardly walk in the nursing home, hit the fresh air, and man, that little lady could scoot down the street. And it was really interesting to watch her. But what the nursing home would do when they couldn't handle her anymore was call me. And I would pick Grandma up and put her in the front seat of my car, and we would go. I had children in activities by then. And we would go deliver them and run around and do different things. And one thing I wanted to point out was in those trying times, it was also very rewarding to put her in the car with me, and we would talk. On one particular occasion, it was summertime, and the children were home and are taking care of each other. Our oldest daughter by then was about 11, 12. And I said, Grandma, we have to go feed the kids. And to her, I just said, we're going out to the farm. And she used to do that, bring lunch out to the farm. Well, we were good with that for a little while, and then she reminded me that our father did not allow us to drive in the country, and did I know I was driving way too fast. And so I asked her how fast we were allowed to go, and she said, well, you remember, Dad said nothing more than 30 miles an hour. And I thought, well, we'll never get there because that's 8 miles out in the country. So anyway, I kind of shifted her conversation, but I learned by doing, and I would hope that this would also offer people the opportunity to learn the steps of what to do with people as they are, either to redirect them or to be able to just move along with their life the way they are. So with that, I would like to introduce our testifier.
Welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself for the record and let us know who you represent.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Richmond, and I am the Vice President for Education and Outreach for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota and North Dakota. The Alzheimer's Association is the world's leading voluntary health organization in Alzheimer's care, support, and research. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today regarding Alzheimer's disease, which is the public health crisis of our time. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive brain disease that damages and eventually destroys brain cells. This leads to a loss of memory, thinking, and other brain functions, and is ultimately fatal. And I would call your attention to the slide deck that's over my head. Alzheimer's is currently the sixth leading cause of death in the United States and is the only one in the top 10 without a means to prevent, cure, or slow its progression. Over 5 million Americans are living with this disease, including an estimated 100,000 in Minnesota. In addition, more than 245,000 people are providing care for those with the disease. With the first of the baby boom generation already over age 65, this group is expected to double by 2030. Currently, one in nine Minnesotans age 65 and older has Alzheimer's, and one in three over the age of 85 and older have the disease. Although Alzheimer's is not normal aging, age is the greatest risk. Taken together, these factors will result in more and more Americans living with Alzheimer's, as many as 16 million by 2050, when there will be nearly 1 million new cases every year. While deaths from other major diseases, including heart disease, stroke, and HIV, continue to experience significant declines, between the years of 2000 and 2010, deaths related to Alzheimer's disease increased by 68%. Direct costs of health care and long-term care for people living with this disease and other dementias are substantial, making Alzheimer's the most expensive disease in America. A newly released 2015 report entitled Changing the Trajectory of Alzheimer's Disease, How a Treatment by 2025 Saves Lives and Dollars, calculates that a treatment introduced in 2025 that would delay the onset of Alzheimer's by 5 years would reduce the number of individuals affected by the disease and the total costs for all payers. As indicated in the slide behind me, a treatment in 2025 that delays the onset would cut the number of people in 2050 who have the disease by 42%, from 13.5 million down to 7.8 million. The Alzheimer's Association report also shows the positive impact of adequate funding and the potential consequences of underfunding. People living with Alzheimer's and other dementias and their families would also see a reduction in their out-of-pocket costs. The current trajectory, without a treatment, families would save $87 billion, or 44% of what they would otherwise spend in 2050. Reaching that 2025 goal would save payers $220 billion over the first 5 years and $367 billion in 2050 alone. Savings to Medicare and Medicaid would account for nearly 60% of these savings. In 2030, Medicaid savings would total $16 billion. In 2050, Medicaid costs would be $99 billion, a savings of $77 billion compared to the current trajectory. Total costs to all payers by 2030 would decrease from $451 billion under the current trajectory to $368 billion, a savings of over $83 billion. In 2015, so this year, the cost to all payers for the care of people living with Alzheimer's and other dementias will total an estimated $226 billion, with Medicare and Medicaid paying 68% of those costs. Without a treatment, costs are projected to increase to more than $1.1 trillion by 2050. Alzheimer's disease is an epidemic. Currently, 11% of Minnesotans over the age of 65 are living with this disease. More Minnesota families are going to be touched by Alzheimer's, and at a frightening rate. Alzheimer's is the public health crisis of this century and the defining disease of the baby boom generation. For millions of Americans, the heartbreak of watching a loved one struggle with this disease is a pain they know all too well. In addition to the human suffering caused by the disease, Alzheimer's creates an enormous strain on the healthcare system and significant burdens on family, state, and federal budgets. In 2009, the Minnesota Legislature created the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group. In 2011, this group released a report detailing recommendations carving a path for the state to address the growing Alzheimer's disease crisis. The report, Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's, the Budgetary, Social, and Personal Impacts, recommends steps that transform Minnesota into a state that is ready, willing, and able to meet the challenges of Alzheimer's disease. It also recommends that the state continues aggressive research for the prevention, treatment, and ultimately cure for Alzheimer's disease. Minnesota is already a leader in addressing the Alzheimer's crisis and has a strong tradition of excellence in Alzheimer's and dementia research. Our state is home to the internationally recognized Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Mayo Clinic and a unique partnership of biotechnology and medical genomics at the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic. Several Alzheimer's projects have been funded in this venture. Successful passage of this legislation would further leverage your continued commitment. The medical infrastructure is in place, and continued investment in research could result in key findings leading to a solution. Given the growing burden Alzheimer's puts on our state, a commitment to research today will yield savings tomorrow. Minnesota families impacted by Alzheimer's and other dementias appreciate the steadfast support of the Minnesota Legislature. We look forward to your continued commitment to address the public health crisis of Alzheimer's disease, and we ask this committee to take a lead role in the 2015 session with a commitment equal to the scale of the crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richmond. Are there any member questions, any member comments on this bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for the testifier. I don't know if it's for her or for Representative Keel. Is there any stem cell research that will be going on via these grants?
Ms. Richmond or Ms. Representative Keel?
No. I don't recall any conversation with all the testifiers we have had.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I certainly with respect to the program being a grant program and looking at institutions to offer potential research studies that they would be looking at, to Representative Keel's remarks, we have not seen specific reference to a stem cell project, but that certainly is something that we might see.
Representative Scott.
Because I would want some sort of a prohibition on embryonic stem cell use. I don't think that's something that the government should be funding. So I don't know if you can give me any guarantees that this money won't go for that. If you could, that would be sure helpful.
Representative Keel.
Representative Scott, I would feel the same way about it. I would be very concerned about that. And I, up to this date, I have not heard one conversation about stem cell of any kind. I know there are some things that they're looking at that would not be embryonic, but at this time, that's what I think.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, if you could just check into that, and if we need to amend it in some way to make sure that doesn't happen, that would really be helpful to me. Thank you.
And it is going to HHS reform after this. Mm-hmm. Any other member questions or comments? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, the A3 amendment, and Representative Keel, I support this bill. It's a good bill, and in some ways, we're picking and choosing. We've had two bills already today setting up research grants, one having to do with another type of medical injury. And I'm going to just point out the amendment. I'm not going to offer the amendment because I don't want to muck up your bill if this is a good bill. But there are other diseases out there that we need to spend more money researching that can help going forward, and is listed in the amendment by Parkinson's disease, diabetes, leukemia, are all ones that we need to put more money in for research as we move forward. But that's my comment, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to offer the amendment. It's basically put the amendment in as the idea that, you know, we need to do more of this, but it's a matter of I'm not going to muck up your bill by putting it on.
Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I know that just visiting the University of Minnesota on their research day and talking about all the things that they're working on, there is considerable research being done with other diseases also. I know diabetes we hear a lot about, and it is certainly a high cost or high need anyway. But I would point out that Alzheimer's is and dementia is growing rapidly, and while in diabetes we have a lot of different methods on how to handle it, and we're looking at how we can slow it up or stop it, Alzheimer's is something that we have no way of being able to slow, or no cures at all thought about. So, but it is a very big concern.
Any other member questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Keel will give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would appreciate your support for this, and I think, you know, as we talk about dealing with senior care, long-term care, that this is certainly important for us to help families not only to be able to delay the cost or slow up the cost of this, but to also help them to deal personally with their own families. And so with that, I'd ask for your support.
Representative Rumbeck.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel or your witness, the Alzheimer's Association, then, will they play a role in making this, you know, this whole effort work? I mean, I'm aware of sometimes sort of organizations that are formed here because we think it's really great idea, you know, to get the board to work together, to be productive, to make decisions, to have, you know, to make progress. May not always happen, and I just wonder what role your group will play in that.
Representative Keel or Ms. Richmond?
Yeah. Part of this, Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, is actually will eventually go to higher ed to talk about the funding for the competitive grant program. That's how that will be handled. As far as some of the initiatives to communicate with people about what they can do to handle someone who's got Alzheimer's to deal with their family. I believe that the Alzheimer's Association has some portion of that, but I'll defer to members of the association.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the association, in terms of the research piece, my understanding is that there will be a group that would be formed and an RFP process put into place for institutions that would be interested in accessing research grant, and I don't know that the association would have a particular role in that part of the process. Our role would be more embedded in the secondary part of the bill with respect to caregiver support.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of House File 278, let me back up, renew my motion that House File 278 will be referred to the Committee on HHS Reform. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, House File 278 is referred to HHS Reform. Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
With that, we will bring down Representative Schumacher, Chair Schumacher, and I will go ahead and move House File 921 to be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. And with that, Chair Schumacher, we welcome you to the committee, and go ahead and let us know about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 921 establishes a long-term care savings account. The development of this really came from trying to find products for my family's business that we could use to help our employees start planning for the long-term care. That's been an interest of mine since I started here in the legislature, is how we pay for long-term care, how we save for long-term care, how we plan for our own long-term care in the future. And we know that the state can't afford it as it is, and as the demographic shift in our state for people growing much older, we'll end up having more people turning 65 than we do entering kindergarten. And so there's a lot of concern about how we fund this in the state and what we do for that. But when we looked, as my family did, for products to be able to help our employees out and our own family out with how they plan for things, long-term care insurance was the only option. And even with the tax credits that are available and some of the other incentives with that, it was still unaffordable for our family to purchase that, and there just wasn't the incentive there for us to do that. And so the only other option was to do nothing or save for yourself and pay the taxes as it is. This bill establishes a long-term care savings account. It's a lot like a health savings account in that qualified expenses can be used from that account, and the money that's put into it can be sheltered up to $1,000 per person per year and $2,000 per couple. I believe that the reason that it's in front of this committee today is so that we can look at the Section 1 subdivisions 2 and 4, where it directs the MMB to establish either the administrator or become the administrator themselves for the plan. And so they have until November, under the current version of the bill, to put a request for proposals on who would administer this or not. And the reason we went with this route and this plan was when I spent some time looking over what other states have done, there's really only two other states in the country that have taken any kind of approach for people to have a tax shelter to save for long-term care savings. That's Nebraska and Arizona. The Arizona plan just allowed for any type of financial product to be used for that, and in Nebraska, they established a long-term care savings plan and had their Department of Insurance take care of that. Since we don't have a Department of Insurance in drafting this, since we modeled the language from the Nebraska plan, we went with MMB instead of, since we don't have, a Department of Insurance. And with that, members, I'll stand for questions, if there are any.
Yep, thank you, Chair Schumacher. Just piggybacking on what you just said, specifically in 2.4, 2.5, there's rulemaking authority, and then in 2.33 and 2.35, directions, guidelines, policies can be established by the State Board of Investment. So those are the specific areas that we're specifically dealing with today. Representative Nelson, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Schumacher, I'm assuming this is because it's dealing with taxes and tax abatement. This is going to end up in Chair David's committee, the Tax Committee. Have you seen a preliminary revenue note on this? Because the Tax Committee gets revenue notes, not fiscal notes. But have you seen that, or have you heard? Has one been requested yet on it? Because I'm sure it's going to have one before it goes to the Tax Committee.
Chair Schumacher,
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, haven't seen one yet, and look forward to that. It's got a long road to go before it even gets to taxes. I believe that's the final stop with it, but we'll be getting that soon, I'm hoping.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's
thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll admit that this question is going to be a little outside the scope of this committee, but I am very curious if you can just indulge me for a moment in terms of how the author might advise me on how this might impact other tax benefit savings that people are saving for in terms of retirement, how it might impact their benefits, Medicare, Medicaid, when they get older. A lot of people are still, trying to create a new balance in terms of how we pay for long-term care, and Medicare has been a catch-all. And I think before we get to a real solution, there'll probably be some crossover. What is your vision for that in terms of how we deal with how it might impact people's benefits as they're trying to build for that whatever scenario their long-term care might be?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson. Really what we're looking to do here is along the same lines of what a health savings account is. And so you would only be able to use this for qualified expenses there. There shouldn't be a reason you would use this before you'd go on Medicaid. You would have those assets considered against what you have there, because you'd want to be using these so that you had the options of where to go with this, not just whatever the state determines, since you're using Medicaid dollars, what you're going to do with that. And so the intent with this is really so people are able to save up what they're able to afford each month, each year, and be able to put it into this account so they can make those expenses down the road when they need to for that care without having to worry about qualifications and eligibility and those types of things.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer and just helping me understand it a little bit better. I share your passion and interest for this subject, so would be happy to talk more with you about it as you continue your work on this bill, so thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, this is a little outside of our purview of the committee, but I won't see this until it comes to the floor. Why, I guess on 2.9, you have a $200,000 lifetime limit, and the mother-in-law who's in a nursing home and has spent down all her assets, that isn't a lot of money. And so why such a low limit as far as having that account?
I am starting to hear the rumble strips on the side of the road, but Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. That's a number I don't have set. That's part of what the Nebraska model was. We just incorporated those same numbers. If you look at it, there's only $1,000 that you can invest as it currently stands right now as a tax shelter, and you can go up to $100,000. The amount, the cap, is adjusted for inflation, but you'd have to live for 100,000 years for that to, or 100 years, excuse me, to actually max that out. And so there is some room for adjustment there in what we see for what makes sense. And if you have any recommendations on how we can make that workable, I would be very happy to take those into consideration.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think all of our goal here is to live to be 100, so I mean, but anyway, that's a good. I was just curious why they mount.
Thank you.
Any other member questions or comments? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Chair Schumacher will give you the final words.
Please support my bill.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 921 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 921 is referred to Commerce.
Thank you.
That, members, we are on the final bill on the agenda, House File 899. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the chance to bring you 899. You have a number of pieces of material in your packets to take a look at, so I would encourage you to sift through that. I think one particularly useful is this document here. It's a Met Council budget page, and you can see, because the bill deals specifically with CTIB, you're able to see the kind of dollars it generates and the kind of dollars that it is infusing into the light rail program in the area. And then also pay attention to the organization chart. This comes really with help from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, because it has been described, you know, in so many ways as being so convoluted and very difficult to understand. And what you end up with is a system that has multiple forms of funding and multiple ways of expending those funds. So I think that's very useful and instrumental. But, Mr. Chair and members, this bill is really dealing with the whole issue of transit planning, funding, and operating in the metro area. And we are able to see with our own eyes and some of the information we've been presented that transit is the focus and responsibility of numerous overlapping agencies as well as the state itself. The Office of the Legislative Auditor, in a recent presentation, if I remember correctly, referred to it as a quote, unquote mess. And the bill before you deals with just one piece of the transit funding pie, and that is CTIB, or the County's Transit Improvement Board. And as you can see from the chart, that they are somewhat of a parallel organization to the Met Council. They have their own stream of funding, and they deal specifically with funding light rail transit and park and rides. And since 2008, CTIB has collected and expended the quarter-cent transit sales tax, which generates about $110 million annually. Now, what's unique is that state law says that CTIB's quarter-of-a-cent transit tax can be spent to plan and build light rail or other dedicated lane modes, fixed guideways, in other words, plus park and rides. And so they can only be focused on just those forms and modes of transit. So in spite of the fact that 90% of transit trips are via regular buses or the Metro Transit bus system, we're spending about 76% of transit funds on LRT-type lines. Also, state law says that CTIB is only responsible, and this is sort of the key of the bill, they're only responsible for 50% of the operating costs of their system. The law says that the state general fund is responsible for the remaining 50% of the operating costs. I think what you would get the impression is that, there's not enough state responsibility by the organization CTIB for what they're building, what they're planning, and what they're owning, which is the transit network. So my bill would simply say, if you build it, you own it, you run it, and you manage it. And you know, there's a number of pieces related to funding and operating a transit system. You're talking about ticket prices, you're talking about labor costs, you're talking about equipment costs, and on and on and on. And in this scheme of things, it's all across the map as to who's thinking about the related costs and their perspective in the whole picture. So to me, if we're talking about common sense reform, common sense spending, the way to begin is to say that CTIB is responsible for 100% of the cost of operating the transit network that they're building. And that's really the essence of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rumbeck. Can I have you move your bill so that it's officially in front of us?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move House File 899, and we refer it to Transportation Committee.
Representative Rumbeck moves House File 899 to be referred to Transportation. I see an A1 in here. Is that an author's amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair, and it's merely technical. So I would like to move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rumbeck moves the A1. Any member discussion to the A1? All in favor of the A1, an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 is adopted. Representative Rumbeck, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's basically my comments on the bill. I do have a couple of nonpartisan House research folks who helped put the bill together. Andrew Lee and Matt Burris are available for further technical questions.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Any initial member questions or discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Runbeck. As I read the bill and I'm reading the summary of the bill, it seems to me you're trying to take the control away from how the local tax dollars that are being raised for CTIB by the five counties and giving it to somebody else, the ability to spend that money. So we're taking local control away from the CTIB participants with the money they're raising. And I guess that's the question I have. Why are we giving the local control over, or somebody else control over, the tax dollars raised by the CTIB counties?
Representative Rumbeck.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I guess the rationale here is that there really doesn't appear to be a backstop in terms of a system that is heading down the road, spending tens of millions of dollars with no opportunity for any review. I mean, if a line becomes somehow determined to be unaffordable, that's non-sustainable, where's that ability for the legislature, who, by the way, then is responsible for a growing body of operational costs, to intervene? And where is the taxpayer expected to have their voice heard? Where is, the rest of the, elected officials? I mean, let's keep in mind that Met Council is not made up of elected officials. So their endorsement of these plans is coming not from citizens and their input. It's coming, or elected officials, it's coming from an appointed body. So there needs to be, in my view, and I think a lot of folks that I talk to, an opportunity for the legislature to weigh in and give a green light.
Mr. Speaker. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, again, but it goes back to the CTIB board. My understanding is elected officials. that have been appointed to the CTIP board from the various counties that are on that board. So they're ultimately responsible for spending to their taxpayers and to their voters to make those decisions. And so there is oversight by the local people. And again, so we're taking the money, the local tax dollars that are being raised to be put in CTIP, and taking the authority to spend that away from the people that are the ones that are raising that money. I mean, I think it'd be like the school board saying, well, we can't let the school board make decisions on how they're going to spend their money on teachers or on buildings, even though they're the elected officials that are supposed to do that, city councils, the county members. It boggles me why we're looking to take away local control over the money that's raised locally.
Representative Rumbach.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, there is a one sheet I passed out that showed we were talking about regional rail authorities, which in the 5-county metro area are collecting taxes to be used to plan, develop, study, and do pre-engineering on light rail lines. And the point is that in some cases those are substantial dollars, and where is the ability to intervene to say that perhaps this is a system, because it is a system that needs another look. Now the language may need to be tweaked, and I'd be happy to talk to you about that. But at this point, it's happening. The outgrowth, the build-out, the implementation, the cost, really with no further look back. And the point is, let's not get ourselves so invested with sunk costs in the planning and feasibility and pre-engineering that nobody dares, to say, well, we better not. I mean, that's where we find ourselves now, is that at a certain point, the decision-making has somewhat rolled along, and no one really feels like they're in a position to say, well, we better not do this. We've already spent, $20, $30 million. So it's out of the concern that a lot of citizens have that, again, because this is run by an unelected, essentially, the big piece of it, an unelected body, there isn't the opportunity for citizens to interact and for their elected officials to really have a direct role in what's happening.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess we have a difference of opinion, and we can argue that all day long, but that's what the world is made of, is differences of opinion. But again, I look at this as the CTIP dollars that we're talking about here are locally raised taxes that were voted on by the local counties that are involved, and we're taking control of how that money is spent away from the local officials. And the state has given the Met Council the task of running the regional transit system that we have, because it's a regional system. And we can argue whether the Met Council should be elected or unelected or appointed differently. I know there are other bills that have been introduced to that, but this is the CTIP money. This is the planning money. This is the money that is raised by the local community, these local counties, the 5 counties that have said, we want to look into this. We're willing to raise the taxes on ourselves. We're willing to spend that money. This is what we're trying to do, and we're taking away from them the ability to spend their locally raised taxes. Again, it'd be the same as us going to a school board and saying, yeah, you raised your property taxes to do these things, but we don't think you should spend it on that. You get to spend it on something else. You're talking to your local city and say, we don't like the way you're spending your money, so we're going to come in and take your tax dollars and tell you how to spend it. Again, this is a whole argument about local control. I think this bill is going in the wrong direction.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Scott.
Well, this is just a target-rich environment here from what you just said, Representative Nelson. First of all, Met Council takes away local control. They tell cities and counties what they can and cannot do in their own areas. Secondly, Anoka County adopted a sales tax without the taxpayers having a say in it whatsoever. And then we're stuck with the bill for the North Star commuter rail that cost $300 and some odd million, maybe more. Representative Rumbach may have that information. And for every round-trip rider from Anoka County that uses that daily, the taxpayer stuck paying $40. something has to be done. And Representative Rumbach is looking for solutions to save taxpayer dollars, save hardworking taxpayers some money, and give some accountability here. We don't go out, no one goes out and buys a house or buys a car without knowing that they can pay for it in the future. That's exactly what hasn't been done here with these transit systems. And Representative Rumbach, I love this bill. I think it's a step in the right direction, and I'm going to support it wholeheartedly.
Seeing no further member questions, I do have several folks on the list that wish to testify. Mr. McLaughlin, Commissioner, if you want to make your way down, you can go ahead and go first. Just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Peter McLaughlin. I'm the Hennepin County Commissioner. I'm chair of the Hennepin County Regional Rail Authority and chair of the county's Transit Improvement Board. I appreciate the opportunity to comment today on House File 899. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to try to confine my remarks to the jurisdiction of this committee, if I can, but if transit questions come up, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
I do think there are some misconceptions and some errors on this chart, just this chart alone. CTIP doesn't get any MVEST money, just for the record, but there are some other misconceptions, and the basic premise of the bill, I think, is off base, if I might say that. Regional railroad authorities were created statewide in the early 80s. They can plan, they can operate rails, and they have property tax authority. The county's Transit Improvement Board was created in 2008. It doesn't build anything. It doesn't own anything. It doesn't operate anything. Okay? We don't own any right of way. We don't own any rolling stock. We don't build anything. And we don't operate any transit. We are a source of capitalization and operating funds for the expansion of the transit system. That's what the legislature told us to do, expand the system. That was our limited province. And there's a specific provision in the law that was enacted in 2008 that said that this money, this quarter-cent sales tax that was imposed by five counties in the metropolitan area by our actions based on our election certificates, we put our political reputations on the line. And it said there shall be no supplantation of existing state money. This was not supposed to be the counties imposing a tax and then supplanting state money that's been going in. That's explicitly in the bill, and that's repealed in this. People need to understand that. And to me, that represents breaking the promise that was made to our residents and taxpayers when we voted as county commissioners to impose this tax. The law said no supplantation. We're not going to just take the state off the hook, take Met Council off the hook. We are going to expand the system. That's what the bill was designed to do, and that's what we have done successfully, and I'm happy to come back and talk about that. But we do it as a source of capitalization and operating funds. We do it as a local elected officials, and we do it in conjunction with the Met Council. It has to be, any investment that we make has to be consistent with the regional transit plan. We can't just about willy-nilly invest in anything we want. That was an agreement that I personally struck and the county struck, but I was in the room with Peter Bell at about 11:30 the Sunday before the 2008 legislative session started, and that was the agreement, that we could invest, we would levy the tax, we would make decisions about where the tax could be spent, but all those expenditures had to be consistent with the regional plan. So we're not free to do anything we want. So I think that's very important. Throughout this, we've had business support. In 2008, there was business support. I would remind you, the State Chamber of Commerce supported the bill in 2008. Many local chambers of commerce supported the bill. I know there have been concerns raised about, you know, we don't know what you people do. There's an annual report to the legislature that we make. It's in statute. We've gotten it in on time. I'd be happy to get copies and distribute it to the members of the committee if that's what you'd like, Mr. Chairman. But it is available. And so the fundamentals here are our charge was to help accelerate the development of transit ways, the expansion of transit. We weren't supposed to do garden variety bus service. We were supposed to concentrate not just on LRT, but on, we've invested in bus rapid transit, the Cedar Avenue busway, for example. We've invested in that as well. And so we do LRT, but we do busways as well. We were told in the legislation that we needed to maximize the availability of federal funds coming into this region, and the New Starts money that comes into this region for the Green Line, for example, that is money that would, you can't convert it to roads. It's money that would otherwise go to other places around the country with which we compete economically. It would go to Portland. It would go to Dallas. It would go to Houston. It would go to Seattle. So we're making the pie bigger. And just since CTIP's been in existence, we've brought in excess of over $700 million in federal funds that otherwise would have gone to our competitor regions across the country. And if you go all the way back to the days before CTIP was created, there's been over $1.5 billion in federal funds that have come here that have expanded our transportation system through investment in transit. I would emphasize again for this committee's purposes that these are local elected officials who are making the CTIP decisions. Met Council has the chair is on it, but 95 of the 100 votes on CTIP are cast by local elected officials from the five counties. And our election certificates are on the line. We think that this bill really does break the promise that was made to our taxpayers. We made representations about the fact that this was going to be about expansion of the system, that this was not going to be just supplanting existing expenditures. This bill would repeal that and change the purpose for which these local taxes were put in place. And I think, Mr. Chairman, it's important that this committee think long and hard about forcing the breaking of the promise that was made to taxpayers and residents in our counties. That's really the essence of what this bill does. We think that, in fact, this committee ought to be thinking long and hard about it as the Intergovernmental Relations Committee, because we have a robust system here in place in the state of Minnesota of the relationship between local government and state government. As a former legislator, and now a local official, I'm familiar with that. I've worked in both systems. I've sat where you sit. And I think it's incumbent upon this committee to think long and hard before it starts forcing the breaking of promises to local residents and taxpayers with a bill like this. And that's really my understanding of this bill. And I think it's a step in the wrong direction that's going to not only stifle transit investment, but in fact going to harm the relationship between state government and local government.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I was going to ask, the Commissioner McLaughlin answered in his testimony.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And being from Eagan, I come from a CTIP county, and we take that responsibility, and our commissioners take that responsibility very, very seriously. We're a county that is really a donor county to our transportation system. Most of the tax money that's raised in our district goes outside of our district. We have very few communities that are served by state roads in our county. It's a county road system, and so our ability to make local control decisions are incredibly important, and I know our commissioners take that very, very seriously. The fact is that the way that the funding system has been set up has not served Dakota County very well, and these few options for local control at this point in our current system are really important to the citizens of Dakota County. And as Commissioner McLaughlin said, there are elected officials at the local level making these decisions and representing our county with these decisions. And so I really am concerned about the notion that we might be taking away local control, particularly when a county like mine has so little local control when it comes to these kinds of options. So thank you for your testimony, Commissioner.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. We'll note that you're in the audience if we have any other questions.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Shetnin, if you will, you can go ahead and make your way down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 899. Just earlier this morning, I had a chance to speak with Representative Runbeck and expressed some of the council's concerns regarding the bill, and particularly on page 2, section 4 of the bill that deals with the guideway development authorization. That states the commissioner in any political subdivision, including but not limited to the council, regional rail authority, county, statutory home rule charter city, may not complete an alternatives analysis or select a locally preferred alternative for a guideway project. The issue with that language is that putting that prohibition in statute really gets in advance or in front of where our local partners provide that analysis today. The council does not do alternatives analysis. We also don't select the locally preferred alternatives. Those come to us from our county partners, our city partners, and so by putting that prohibition in place, what this bill does is makes the state of Minnesota really the guideway planner. And I know that in throughout our system, we've got counties and groups that are interested in looking at future investment, say the Highway 169 corridor, the Red Rock corridor, Rush Line, potentially 35W, Mr. Chair, the Highway 36 East. All of those potential corridors would have to stop, and the local partners would not be able to use their local funds in order to do that analysis without the state, the House passing a bill, the Senate passing a bill, and the governor signing that bill. And it really, abruptly stops that process. And I know that Commissioner McLaughlin did a nice job of explaining that, that again, these are local dollars that go into this. I also did mention to Representative Runbeck, and maybe this will help the committee, but back in 2011, in the transportation funding bill that was passed, Representative Beard, Senator Gimsey, Commissioner Sorrell, and Chair Haig agreed to some language that is also included in Chapter 147 that has MnDOT and the council do a report on guideway investment. And I hear Representative Runbeck speak to that the state finds out about these issues so far down the line. Well, in fact, that report has the council and MnDOT come forward to the legislature, report to the finance chairs and the transportation chairs, explaining what the transitway or the guideway system will look like. And we have in that report, we have to explain what the capital costs are for those projects, what the operating costs are for those projects, and we have to show where those funds would come from for 10 years, including the operations of that. So I think, and I know that this is the Government Operations Committee, and we cover most of this in the Transportation Committee, so that's why I just wanted to share that in current law, a lot of that already is in place. And I brought a copy of it. I just printed it off real quickly, and I can pass that around if members are interested. But the council is concerned about this bill as well. Again, we think that it is getting in front of the locals who really do those alternatives analysis, who select the locally preferred alternative. And when that takes place, that is when the state gets involved. And I would like to say to Representative Rumbeck, and I apologize I don't have a copy of the report, but I'd be happy to provide a copy to you and the members, and I assume that this bill, if it passes, will go to transportation, and I'm certain that we'll have a copy of that there. But I think that this bill certainly misses the mark, and I think that we already cover it.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, just a quick question maybe for the author or Mr. Shetland. Section 4 worries me, too, because I don't know. I hazard a guess. I think I'm the one member at this table that has most recently been involved in a locally preferred alternative discussion and vote as a city council member with the Southwest Light Rail. And I think I'm reading it right, but it kind of, from what I understand, it completely takes the local city council out of the picture until the legislature decides whether or not it's a good project or how to fund it, or it puts money towards it without even knowing what it's putting money towards because nothing's been studied yet. So I'm just a little confused. Maybe you can clarify it for me.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joachim. I think the alternative is that we don't have somebody at the top, the council, for example, doing alternative analyses. We don't have analysis going on. It is broken into little bitty bits, and yet we're talking about building, you know, a 20-line system, very piecemeal then, piecemeal thinking, piecemeal planning. And I'll go back to the point that no one is thinking about the overall cost of owning it, running it, maintaining it, and operating it.
Representative Joachim.
Well, I guess we differ in opinion there, Representative and Mr. Chair. I, having been through the process, we felt like our voice was pretty well heard on picking a locally preferred alternative. And from my understanding, the Met Council kind of is that regional 10,000-foot glance of how the project's supposed to run or what the project could look like. Also, as a member of the Corridor Management Committee for Southwest Light Rail, too, we were constantly being told by the Met Council, you know, you're here representing the whole entire line, not just your city, too, but we were able to bring our city's perspectives to the table and really look at it as a regional project and make it better, because there were issues we had at the local level. Trust me, there's an operations and maintenance facility in Hopkins that we had a lot of discussion about because we were concerned, but we were able to get through the process of having the locals at the table. We were able to get our voices heard and get some things done. So just a comment from somebody that most recently went through the process.
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add that what the bill does not just deal with rail projects. It also deals with highway, BRT, express bus. And so we're talking about the state having to go ahead and basically bless these projects before we can even look at whether or not a highway BRT project is a good idea or additionally express bus. So this is what I think we would see as a real reach into local control at that point, and also to representatives' comments about what would happen with the locals in the planning stage. The way I read the bill is the same way that you do.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Shetland, if I could ask you a question regarding the governor's proposal for the imposition of the half-cent sales tax in Carver County that we've talked about, I believe, previously in transportation. I did have some numbers run. Roughly, that's $3.4 million coming out of Carver County, which is a CTIB opt-out county, correct?
Correct.
But you told us in transportation that that money is coming out irrespective of whether we continue to opt out or not. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe answer the question to Representative Rundeck's bill. You talked about local control being important, but we don't have any control over this new tax that you're imposing on an opt-out county. So if you could maybe help us out with that.
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I appreciate that. I didn't bring a copy of the bill, of the governor's transportation funding bill, but what is also included in that bill is an annual report to the legislature that outlines where the investments are being made and the how they plan to be paid for, both capital and operating, that we have to report back to the legislature annually. Because if this were to pass, the sales tax were to pass, it would, under the governor's plan, it would be imposed by the state. And that is where you would have an elected body passing that sales tax.
Representative Nash.
I have one more testifier on the list that I'd like to get to soon. If there's other questions for you, we'll bring you back up, Mr. Shedden. But Arlene McCarthy is the last one I have on my list.
Mr. Chair, Arlene is with the council, and I
perfect.
Think I covered that.
So thank Excellent.
You.
Then we'll move on to Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I had to step out. I had some constituents, so I missed part of the conversation. But as I was looking at this and looking at what the legislature would be tasking themselves with, and then previous bill that came before us where we'd also be reviewing rules, it looks like we're going to be pretty busy, and then also kind of top down a little bit. So I was just wondering, you know, I am concerned, you know, about the issue that Representative Runbeck raised about it being piecemeal. And so I'm just wondering, these projects as they come forward, I'm wondering if Mr. Shetman could, you know, comment that, is it, you know, comment on that comment is how the, you know, regional planning works. And then I had a follow-up question.
Mr. Shetman.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. And I'm going to take a brief shot at this. And if you need more detail, then I'll ask Ms. McCarthy to come up. She is our planning director for Metropolitan Transportation Services. But what the council does is prepares a what's called the Transportation Policy Plan, which is a federally required document that it has us take a look at transitway investment and transit and investment over the course of the next 10 years. And so what we do is we work with our partners at CTIB and other partners to look at, you know, what type of funds do we have available and how do we look at what we think those investments would look like into the future. And so I don't think it's necessarily piecemeal because our friends at CTIB also create a program as well, and we work together to make sure that they mesh with each other. And then, as I mentioned before, we also prepare this guideway report that we present to the legislature, which that is consistent with our planning that we do at the council and that we do with our partners at CTIB. That may be just a surface, but if you need more information, I can certainly ask Ms. McCarthy to come speak to that if you'd like.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shetman. I think that's good for now. Maybe I can get some more detail later. And then I did just have a follow-up question based on Representative Joachim's remarks about being a part of the process. So if we shifted to the process that is outlined in this bill, from your perception, what would we lose as far as input, you know, looking at the process that is in place right now, input from locally elected officials and, you know, local people? And then I'm just wondering again, and I apologize, I haven't had a chance to review the details of the bill, but, you know, the hours that are put into that project, just a rough estimate, you know, coming up with a locally preferred alternative, you know, and the hours put into that and what would be lost if we changed our system.
Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Seltzer, you know, to talk about the project development phase, that really is not the council. The council doesn't go through alternative analysis phase, so that's probably better answered by someone from the County Regional Rail Authority or CTIB or someone other than for me to explain, because we don't participate in that phase. We pick it up once the locally preferred alternative has been put in place. And so I'm sorry I don't have that answer for you, but and I know you don't serve on the Transportation Finance Committee, because otherwise I could have that ready for you at that point. But I don't have that answer for you today. But I know, just so you know, is that work that is being done at the local level to go through the alternatives analysis phase is funded through local dollars as well. There aren't state dollars in that. So in order to get to that point, to be able to look at a potential transitway or guideway, what would need to happen is that we'd have to come to the state, again, to have them pass a law allowing us, the council, the county, whoever, to do an analysis on that. So that is jumping way ahead of the process that we have today. It's the legislature imposing, like I said at the beginning, the state really becomes the transportation planner at that point and decides which transitways that the state would like the council or the city or the county to look at versus the locals using their funds in order to decide themselves.
Follow-up, Representative Seltzer?
I think I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Schimpf.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what the seven-county metro area sales tax covers, what it pays for transportation, for transit?
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I assume you're talking about the current quarter-cent sales tax. That is levied by CTIB and the CTIB partners, so I'll let Commissioner McLaughlin speak to that.
Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lane. CTIP pays for 30% of the capital cost of the projects. 30%. The breakout is 50% federal, 30% CTIP, 10% County Rail Authority, and then the state at 10%. So the state has the smallest fraction. In addition to that, the funds are used, the federal government pays on a reimbursement basis, so that the CTIP funds are, we're actually paying for 60% of the actual outflow of cash until we get reimbursed by the federal government. So that's an important function that the CTIP funds perform as well. And I would just note that the federal government just raised, for Southwest Corridor, just raised the local financial plan from a medium rating to a high rating because the Hennepin County Rail Authority just committed its funds for Southwest Corridor, and CTIP committed its funds for the Southwest Corridor. And so that's how we get to be a high rating. That's how we compete for the 50% federal share.
Representative Lane.
And would this bill change that? I mean, take this local funding and say that you can't do anything unless the state gives you a pass to do it.
Well, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lane, I think this stifles the planning process. It gets in the way of the local planning process, and that's important. And it also starts consuming these funds for regular bus service and the 100% of the operating costs, and it starts to dissipate the quarter-cent sales tax in a way that will stifle our ability to bring in additional federal funds and build additional projects like the Gateway Project in Washington County or the other projects that are on the books.
Representative Lane.
So just a comment then, following Representative Seltzer, that following on top of the rulemaking bill that we heard the other day, which sounds like on the surface like there's a desire to take control of rulemaking to make sure it's done the way the legislature wants it, in fact, it actually would stop regulations dead in their tracks because nothing would ever get approved, major projects would have no regulation because there wouldn't be any rulemaking that would be able to get passed again and approved by the legislature in this messy process that we have here. And now we have this similar sort of thing by saying we want to get control over this, we'll just stifle projects.
Commissioner.
I'm very disturbed.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might add, again, it's currently a 10% share that comes from the state. To have the state have to authorize this, we're talking about other counties, representatives from other counties from greater Minnesota, and I served here, I know how that works, but the knowledge base in those other 80 counties about where Hiawatha Avenue is, where the Gateway Corridor is, I mean, it's not there. And it seems like a mismatch of knowledge and authority that's being created in this bill. And I don't think that that's a good idea. In addition to that, there's this notion that there's not a lot of due diligence. There's a lot of due diligence that the federal government imposes on this process as well, and that's not to be overlooked. To get their 50% share, you really have to perform.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, members, for a good discussion. Representative Runbeck, as this moves to transportation, I encourage you to work with those interested in this to make the bill stronger. With that, I'll renew my motion, the House file, or Representative Rumbeck's motion, the House file 899 be re-referred to the Transportation Committee as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
Sorry, Representative Nelson, we're already in the middle of the vote. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Division?
Division being requested. There, all in favor, please raise your hand. Okay, those opposed? There being eight ayes and six nays, the motion prevails, and House File 899 is being re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Thank you, members. Thank you for a good discussion, good committee today. We will see you tomorrow. Meeting is adjourned.